Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and it is the middle of July 2013 as I record this. A lovely summer day in London. We're finally having a bit of a heat wave. And it is episode 160 of the podcast. Oh my goodness. And if you are a regular listener, that must be about 80 hours of my voice, which is quite exciting. I still love the podcast. And whenever I think I really must like reorganize my time, the podcast is one of the things I just don't ever want to give up because I really enjoy it. And today's episode is certainly no different. I have a brilliant interview with Dan Holloway, who is somebody who challenges me around the commercialism of self-publishing and talks about experimental and alternative literature and really raises some questions about creative expression and, you know, creating without an end in mind, you know, whereas pretty much everything I do has an end in mind, i.e. publishing and getting a book out there and selling it and, you know, that type of thing. So I hope you'll enjoy this discussion. I certainly did. The audio quality does start out a little bit fuzzy because Dan lives in the middle of nowhere, so and he was on a phone, but it evens out pretty quickly. So I think you'll enjoy the conversation, so definitely give it a chance. There is a word that some people may consider adult in the show, because this is a clean podcast, but it's used in the word means self-pleasure. I'm sure you can imagine what that word is, but it's used in the context of literature, so I still think this is considered a clean podcast, but I just wanted to give you fair warning. But I think you'll find the show fascinating today, so on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today on the podcast I have Dan Holloway. Welcome, Dan.
Hello.
Hello. So just as a bit of an introduction, Dan is a poet and author of fiction, as well as running 79 Rap Press, which publishes conceptual work. And he performs his poetry and hosts the New Libertines, a spoken word show. So does that sum you up, Dan? You know, what else do you do? That's quite a lot already.
Goodness. I write occasionally for The Guardian. I have a column in Words of Jam magazine, and I'm part of the Authors Electric collective blog, and I write occasionally for and do what I can to promote the Alliance of Independent Authors.
Yes, you are truly everywhere, and it's marvellous.
And not the Oxford Literary Festival I run, that's the other thing.
Oh, right, yeah. That will be not the Oxford Literary Festival.
Yeah. Not the Oxford Literary Festival.
Which is fantastic. There's lots you've mentioned there, but tell us a bit more about your writing and creative background.
My creative background has very little to do with writing, as I'm sure you've heard me say many times. I grew up in a house full of books, so it had a lot to do with reading. The big event in our house was usually the publication of that year's volume of Virginia Woolf's Diaries, so that got me into reading. But my main creative background has always been art, and I first sort of wanted to become something creative after going to see a room of Mark Rothko's pictures at the Tate. And that sort of then trundled along, and I tried very, very, very hard to do art, and failed miserably, but still loved it. And then in the 90s, I was lucky enough to be there at the Turner Prize exhibition, where Tracy Emin's My Bed was showing, and also Steve McQueen's Deadpan. So that sort of more conceptual art got me into seeing what the creative possibilities were for someone who wasn't necessarily any good at art. And that then combined with, I was of the generation who read Milan Kundera all the time, which I'm sure I say everyone my age must have, as a student, read The Unbearable Lightness of Being and gone, oh, this is so deep, sort of like people did about Smith. And that combined with Tracy Emin is sort of what led me to want to write.
Yeah, and tell and what have you been writing since then? You know, tell us a bit more about the fiction, because I didn't really mention that.
It started like I'm sure everyone does with writing emo poetry from the age of 15. Most people stop at 18, but I sort of stopped at 30. And then I started, the first novel I wrote was, how to describe it? It was called Songs from the Other Side of the Wall, and it's literary fiction in sort of Murakami vein, sort of slightly whimsical might be the, no, whimsical's a good word, but it's not always bad. I like whimsical.
Mm.
Whimsical literary fiction set it in post-communist Europe. That's always been another fascination, having grown up with Threads and When the Wind Blows and then the fall of the Berlin Wall, how we see ourselves and our identity and after communism, after the fall of the Berlin Wall is something that sort of obsesses me. And then I discovered the internet fully and wrote The Man Who Painted Agnieszka's Shoes, which I wrote on Facebook as part of a Facebook group, and I wrote interactively. That was it. That was in 2009. And after that I wrote, I tried very, very, very hard to do it right, or what I thought was right, and wrote a thriller, which sold reasonably well, but really wasn't me, and also wasn't particularly good. So I would love to be able to write, I love thrillers to read, but I can't write them. And then I discovered poetry in the end of 2010-11, poetry proper, as opposed to emo goth.
I love that, poetry proper, not the emo stuff. That's awesome.
Well, there's still a lot of emo stuff. Everything I do is about emotion. And there's a lot. Lots of literary writers like to go around and quote this Oscar Wilde thing, whatever it is about passion being the first step on the road to bad writing. Which I think is absolutely wrong. Everything for me is about passion and about feeling and about emotion. So I still have that emo thing, I think.
Mm. So that's been...
I've been waffling, sorry.
No, I'm finding it fascinating. You know, for people listening, I wanted Dan on the show because I am unashamedly commercial and, you know, entrepreneurial businesswoman about the writing world. And although I'm, you know, creative and spiritual and all those things, you know, I'm in this as a business. And, you know, what I love about what you do is you just seem to play a lot more at what's possible without the thought of, well, is this rude to say, without thought of the outcome?
That's fair enough. I've never really worried about the outcome of things, because it's always about sort of seeing what happens. Sort of what happens if I push that button. I'm the archetypal person not to leave in the room with a big red button that says do not push.
But then one of your recent books, Evie and Guy, tell us about that, and we'll come back to the poetry.
Evie and Guy is a novel that's written entirely in numbers. I don't know what I'm allowed to say about it, for reasons that you are, because I can say it and you can edit it out if it's not appropriate.
Yeah.
It's basically, I take two people, it's a love story. I take two people and I list the time, date and duration of every act of masturbation in both their lives. So it's literally just a list of numbers, and the reader can then either read them separately or read them side by side. It's great for Amazon, for sales of Kindle. There's one person who reviewed it said, the best way to read it is on two e-readers side by side. So anyone who thinks one e-reader is enough, it's not. And you can sort of play with determining how you think their relationship has been is reflected in these figures. And what I was trying to do is to remove me as the author completely from the text, making the single choice right at the start of the book what I was going to do, getting it out there and over with, and then literally just listing, making no selection, no editing, no choosing. Like every book that I've ever tried to write in words, we choose, don't we? We say, I need to write about what they're wearing, but I'll only write about what they're wearing in chapter 27 to give an idea of their character. Or I'll describe one meal they have, or one place they go to work, or what the weather was like on one particular day. And we choose which day we're going to use, and that's intruding us upon their lives. And I wanted to get rid of that by not choosing at all, by literally listing everything, deciding what it was I was going to list. Hopefully something that readers can build stories around, but then getting rid of me, saying, right, I'm going to make no more choices, it's all up to you. And most importantly as well, it's all up to the characters.
I probably embarrassed myself at the London Book Fair when you showed me the book, and I said, oh, it's in a code. Thinking with my thriller head that clearly I had to work out the key, and I would be able to turn all the numbers into letters and there would be a story.
Well, lots of people have said, is there a code? And I said, no, it's not intended to be difficult. I think that that's also a thing that people have with literary fiction and experimental fiction, is that it's difficult. And it's not meant to be difficult at all. It was just meant to help us look at things in a different way. In particular, when it's to do with identity, like I was saying about communism and how we see ourselves in a post-communist world. When we think of ourselves in linguistic terms, we're using something that's been given to us, something that's been predefined. All these terms we use to think about ourselves, aren't I? Tall, short, fit, athletic. Do I like food? Do I do this, that, or the other? Am I whatever? They're all terms that we've inherited and have nothing to do with us. We get no input into it. So our experience of the world, our senses, the way we sort of live from day to day is dulled, and we're put into these boxes that have been given to us. And I wanted to get rid of that and help people to see their lives in a different way that wasn't something that had been handed to them, but was something that they were starting to construct from scratch and in their own terms. If that makes any sort of sense at all.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. And I also think it's interesting you said it's not meant to be difficult, it's meant to be interesting, whatever it was you said instead of difficult.
Different,
yeah. And I mean, you...
Seeing the world from a different angle, just like Cubist art or something like that, isn't meant to be difficult, it's just showing you a different angle.
Yeah, and you use the word experimental. So what is that the difference between experimental and literary fiction? As in, literary fiction still has a clear narrative structure and conforms to still, you know, rules. Whereas what you're saying is experimental is stuff like what you've done here, just numbers.
Well, I don't know that literary fiction is a genre at all. I'd say personally, it's more of a category than a genre. But I think experimental fiction is something you don't know where it's going to go. You want people to see things differently. You're playing, and it's not necessarily about the story or about the plot or about anything in particular. It's just seeing what you can do with language, and that could be something that's very, very not difficult at all. It could simply be. And I've written sort of saucy limericks, for example. Dark limericks, I should say, emo limericks, which is experimental because it's just taking something that you don't associate with the form.
Yeah.
I guess it's not...
Well, I think what interests me...
It's not doing what you expect, I think.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, and I've said to you before, I absolutely respect this about you, that you come out with these projects, but I've still got to ask, how are the sales?
The sales of Evie and Guy.
Yeah.
It's been downloaded over 300 times, which is great.
Yeah.
But then the downloads are free.
Yeah. Where can people download it for free, just so they know?
They can download it from my website, which is danholloway.wordpress.com.
Right, brilliant.
Likewise, my poetry is free there. But still, for non-Amazon books, that's not, I'm happy with it. It's not about the sales. The sales I was doing was when I wrote the thriller, and it sold reasonably well. It sold a few thousand copies, but it wasn't any good.
Yeah,
it was. It was good, but that was all it was. And I don't really like doing stuff that's not as good as I could make it.
No, and I love that. I love that thing. You know, I love that sentiment, I suppose, I think. And I want, you know, there's a lot of things that I want to write that I'm not writing until I have paid the bills enough that I can allow myself to write things that might not sell. But at the moment,
the classic film director way of doing things, isn't it?
Right.
Of alternating personal projects with commercial projects.
Yeah, like blockbuster with something else. Yeah, maybe that's the idea. But what I like is that you, and I've always struggled with the kind of permission aspect of things, and you know, following the rules and stuff like that. I'm the eldest child.
You wrote a very good blog post about that a few months ago, I remember.
Yeah, about permission, and it's taken me a long time to kind of be able to get out from behind that. What, are you allowed to do that? And that's what I kind of think, you know, you don't... Have you ever felt that, or is that not something you've grown up with? You've actually grown up with, I can do whatever I want.
No,
creatively.
Not at all. It's partly because I had a sort of very traditional education. I read authors because I'm a publisher as well. I get sort of slush in, and sometimes I read things and I think, oh my goodness, I could never do that. And I think it's the fact I've had a very traditional education is somewhat of a disadvantage, because there's a sort of really naff truism that you can't think outside of the box, because the box is always the centre of the picture still. You can only be truly original if you don't know what the box is. And the writers I've published who've been, and Penny Goring and Andy Harrod are the two, I think, are the prime examples of this. They're so far out of the box that there's almost like there's no awareness that there is a box to be in or out of. They just do it. And Penny puts together sentences. She just says, I like this word, I like that word, I like that word. Like, that's a three-word sentence then. And the whole book is like that. And it's something that you just wouldn't think about, or if you did think about it, it would be contrived. So I think it's not that I think I can do anything. And I find myself self-censoring a lot, subject matter-wise in particular. So that's still a problem, which is why I guess I go more into experimenting in form than subjects. The subjects are actually quite conventional. Basically everything I write is a fairly solid normal love story. So I experiment with the form, because I do worry about self-censorship with what we say. Certainly in terms of, I don't want someone to come after me because I've said what I want to say, as it were. There are things that I would really love to write, but it would put me and my family at risk. I did it because I think there is a tendency for writers to say, you must write whatever you want, you must never censor yourself. But in general, they tend to be the people who've never had a dark thought in their lives. I very much do censor myself and don't do whatever I want to do. And I also get frustrated. I'm not as original and experimental as I'd like to be. So I'm always trying to forget things. I think that's what I'd say.
I'm trying to unremember
the rules all the time.
No, that's really good. And that actually leads into the kind of indie thing, because, you know, I'm very happy self-publishing, you know, a proud indie author, but I also would take a traditional book deal, you know, because I want to try that. And I'm also, write, you know, less experimental fiction and, you know, could be mainstream type fiction, but you are fiercely indie, aren't you? So, you know, talk about why you are and what that has to do with the creative side.
I don't know that... I was thinking about this, and I'm not sure that I am fiercely indie.
Mm.
I'm very much that I would always self-publish, but I think that's because I'm a particularly awkward person to work with, and I wouldn't wish it on that sort of relationship on either me or a publisher, because I think both of us would come out badly. But I'm mainly fiercely pro great books, and in particular great books by unrepresented voices. And for people being able to tell their own stories in their own voices and not be frightened of failing. And I think when I started writing, self-publishing was where that was easiest to do. I'm not sure it is anymore. I think if I was starting writing now, I weren't such an awkward curmudgeon, I'd be tempted to write for small presses, because I think that's where the really exciting literature is at the moment.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of pressure on self-publishers to conform to this idea of where everything is about what you sell.
Mm.
And how to shape your writing into something that will perform a certain function. And that, I can completely understand that, but I think that doesn't suit me at all. So I'm not sure that. And I'll stay within the self-publishing scene because I couldn't not, and also because I want to keep them reminding people that there's more to it than that. But I don't know that it would necessarily suit me if I was starting now.
Mm.
I think that there are a lot of great small presses doing really experimental, wacky, fabulous things. People like Penned in the Margins, and even someone as mainstream as Melville House. Lazy Fascist Press. So-called press, all sorts of people doing absolutely fabulous things.
And aren't they just, I mean, now we've got indies forming collectives and things. I mean, are these small presses, like your small press, I mean, is it not just a small group of people who are still thinking in a similar way that get together, which is,
yes,
I think, what,
yes,
a lot,
think,
of indies are turning into, indie
authors. I think that's probably right. And a lot of them have come out of the internet scene of the last 10 years or so. It's as though that's what they've crystallised into. Yeah.
And it's this fragmenting world where, like you said, Lady Fascist Press or whatever, you know, can find a niche online, whereas very unlikely they could have done that in the past.
Yes, because you can be a tiny niche. It doesn't matter whether the three people who like what you do are scattered sort of 8,000 miles away from each other, because you can be brought together online.
Mm. Which I really like. And but I think what you said, you know, what we were saying about the rules and the box, you know, and why, I think you said to me once, we were talking about it, and I think you said that the big publishers have to pick books that fit into the box, or, you know, into a clear genre, because they can't afford not to have, you know, not to please the masses, I guess. They have to please the masses with every book, and they can't really take any risks. So I think your point at the time was that these small presses or individual authors can be more creative, and that more creativity is coming out of the non-publishing scene.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of it's online, and a lot of it's coming from blogs and Tumblr and places like that, where there's absolutely no pressure. It doesn't matter if you never sell a copy.
Mm.
That's wonderfully freeing artistically. And not having shareholders, of course, is wonderfully freeing.
And presumably paying bills in another way also.
Yes. I work full time, so I don't have to make a living from my writing.
Mm.
I don't know, I think I wouldn't write as much or as well if I did write full-time.
Mm.
I think having 30 minutes an hour to do it every day has helped me.
Mm.
It focuses you.
That's more than some full-time writers probably spend.
Yes, quite.
I seriously can't. I mean, if you take 10 years to write a book, you're not spending half an hour on it every day, are you?
No, quite. I mean, if we're in relation to Vikram Seth being in rather a lot of trouble.
Oh, yes. Oh. If people don't know, isn't he being asked for $1.7 million back because he hasn't delivered his manuscript?
Which is, it seems to me to be fair enough. The time he was given,
I think I think that's fair enough too. It's like
he's a wonderful writer, but I have very little sympathy.
No, exactly, because it's not, you know, people have to understand about advances that it's not a gift. It's against advances, you know, sorry, against royalties. So you have to make some royalties.
and they will have budgeted the return on that advance of a particular point in time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you have to do when you're in business.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's in really, and why I wanted to talk to you is that I'm very aware of how skewed in one direction, you know, I am with my creativity. And although, to be fair, I've written a few emo poems in the last year.
Excellent.
That won't see the light of day. That's for sure. But anyway, coming back to you, so you talked about a few exciting things going on. Tell us about a few of those exciting things and point people at them so they can go find them, because presumably they're not on Amazon.
No, most of it isn't on Amazon. I think, yes. Now, what was it? Mainly it's on, you find a lot of it on Tumblr, in particular Altlit, which is, how would I describe it? It's an umbrella term for, it's writing that takes the internet as its subject and its medium. And it does it in some very strange ways. It uses things like image macros, which are combinations of pictures and seemingly random words. It uses lots of misspellings and internet slang, but it nonetheless deals with very important questions of who we are in a digital age and how we look at ourselves in a digital age. And it's about layers and the way that we construct ourselves from layers that our online persona is constructed from. Our statuses, how we want people to see us, and our sense of worth is constructed from the number of likes we have, or the number of shares we have, or the number of reblogs, or whatever it is we get online. And so it asks some very important questions about emptiness and substance and identity. And where to find it. There's a wonderful site called Altlit Library. Mm-hmm. Which has links to all the sort of the seminal works in about the internet. For other really exciting things, and some of the most exciting things in self-publishing are not things you'll find online at all, but things that you'll find at zine fairs, for example, or from tiny publishers who literally fold up books in their front room. So a good place to look is somewhere like Sabotage, if you know Sabotage Reviews, who review the ephemeral, as they call it, which is spoken word and pamphlets and chapbooks and zines and sort of internet blogs and that sort of thing. And something that's almost mainstream now, which is 3AM, I don't know if you know 3AM magazine, which is where it's all the start of the offbeat literary movement. Which is the offbeat and the brutalist were the first internet-based literary movements. So there's a lot of wonderful, slightly avant-garde, but very engaged poetry and prose that you'll find in places like that. All of it trying to deal with this fundamental question of who are we in a digital age, which very little mainstream fiction seems to bother with.
No, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's so funny as you're talking, I'm kind of thinking, this is like post-apocalyptic Amazon. It's almost like if you said that Amazon was, you know, the normal world, and then this is all the post-apocalyptic stuff that kind of Which is awesome. We have to make up a word. Right, now, I know we're talking, I'm finding this so fascinating, but I do want to ask you about your poetry now, because you're a performance poet. You don't just write poetry and, you know, put it on pages. You perform it, which I find amazing. So talk about that. Like, you know, how does that work and, you know, where do you do that?
I didn't actually start as a performance poet. Because I'm quite gobby and exhibitionist, I always wanted to perform my writing. And so I started for 2 years before I got into performance poetry. I was performing short stories. So I started with my book launch for my very first book at their local bookshop. And then I went on to do literary death match when it came to London a couple of years ago. And there are all sorts of, I went down to Brighton to do something called Gritlit. And this was all reading short stories. And then I just happened to bump into a performance poet one day at a show I was arranging. She said, you know, I said, why don't you come up and read something? And she stood there and I thought, oh, there's a book she's reading from. Mm. And she just proceeded to burst into this beautiful sort of retold fairy tale. Engage directly with the audience. I thought, wow, that's extraordinary. I want to do that. And so I started going to poetry slams, and I started incorporating poetry into the events I ran at everywhere from bookshops to art galleries to, we did a show at Rough Trade Records on Brick Lane, and we've now toured it all around the country. But it was entirely an accident that I got into performance poetry. Wanting to perform was the first thing, rather than being a poet and this being the way to do it.
Well, because I'm listening to that, and I think a lot of people are listening to that and saying, no way. You know, like people don't believe it, but I'm an introvert and I'm not somebody who wants attention. It's just, and when I speak, I think all about delivering value to the audience and trying not to, you know, I'm nothing to do with it almost, you know what I mean? Mm. But what you're doing, like you just said, direct interaction with the audience, and it's like, I'm sure people are very scared.
Well, I'm an introvert too. That's the thing, and that's the thing about performance is it's perfect for introverts.
Mm.
Because I mean, if I were at a party, then I would make for the corner of the room and hide.
Mm.
But once you're there and you've got an audience, and there's something happens when you're behind a microphone, or when you've got a book, or when you're performing your material, there's a structure to it that takes away that sort of social fear that goes with a lot of introversion.
Mm.
And it's incredibly therapeutic, as well as being great for the audience. Because you're drawing them into your story in a way that you can't really do on the page. They're investing themselves in it. There's more than one sense going on. They're watching, they're listening, there are smells and tastes and all sorts, because it's a fully immersive experience in a way that sitting reading a book isn't. And with you there talking to them, you're taking them and leading them on a journey and in the way that you intended the story to be written. So you're actually building a much closer relationship with your audience than I think you can do either online or just by giving them the book.
Which I totally get. And then I think I'm sitting here thinking, why am I so scared of it? And, you know, because I'm a professional speaker, so I speak, and being in front of people isn't scary. I think it's fear of rejection. It's fear of some heckler going, you're shit, get off.
Yeah.
Does that happen?
You do get hecklers sometimes. We had our famous poetry brawl that I was involved in a few years ago. Or last year, in fact.
I throw my chapbook at you, sir.
It was at not the Oxford Literary Festival. We had a poet who was performing a wonderful feminist poem, and there was a drunken youth walked by outside, and he shouted in typically Oxford heckle. He said, she's monologuing. And she shouted back, it's poetry, you twat. And then he wandered off down the street, and a member of the audience decided he wanted to play the knight in shining armour and went out and sort of a brawl ensued. And it's gone down in Oxford literary legend. So
wow.
You do get hecklers.
Those poets.
But in general, audiences are so warm and responsive. And they're there because they want to be there.
Yeah.
It's not like looking at the look inside on Amazon, just sort of casually flicking through. They're there because they really want to read, or they really want to hear what you've got to say.
Yeah. And if people want to try this, I mean, obviously they can, if they Google Poetry Slam, they'll probably find something in a big town near them. And then if you just go along and get to know the organisers, you can just say you want to perform. Is that how it works?
You sign up on the night.
Oh, really?
That's how you do it. Yeah. Yes. Yes. No, you, most places have open mic nights. Yes, just look at the online, wherever your local listings magazine is, and go along. And you get 3 or 4 minutes to read something, anything you want. Try it out, and that way you get to see if you've got a taste for it. And because the focus isn't on you, there's no pressure. There'll be someone else on in 2 minutes' time. So
yeah,
there's no pressure on, they're not all looking at you. They're there to have a good time, and they will be really supportive of newcomers.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm challenged, and I've been saying this for ages, but I really need to get into this in some form. Because I went, and this is a bit different, but I went and made a book at the London Centre for Book Arts. I went and made an actual physical book, and that was really brilliant. I loved it. It was like, it was so much fun, and doing something that was off the internet, I think.
Yeah.
Is important. And this, like you're saying, it's another way of transforming your creativity into another dimension, and also challenging yourself, I guess.
Yes, I think that there are a lot of book making courses around now, I think, which is really wonderful. And you can produce some fabulous things. We have one in Oxford at our local bookshop. They have an in-house stationer.
Brilliant.
And she runs bookbinding courses there. And you literally take what you want to make into a book, and she'll show you how to stitch it and cut it. And
Well, that's what I mean, I would love, I will at some point make limited edition, you know, print things. And, you know, I think I see this as the future of people making money from their creativity. Is like we were saying, you know, do something to make the money that you need to live, and then do more creative things in that artisanal sense.
Yeah.
Exciting. Very exciting. Well, so if people want to know some more tips from Dan on speaking, you did a lovely guest post on the blog, which also features in the book, How to Market a Book.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so it's out there, and your website is there and everything. But just one question I do get asked is from poets. Poets regularly email me and say, how can I sell more poetry? So is the answer, go perform it? I mean, do you actually sell poetry books at performances?
That is the answer. If you're not going to put it as an appendix to an erotica book, which is the obvious answer, then... Yes, the answer is go out and perform it. There's a lot written about how poetry sales are in decline, and there's the famous Salt is now pulled out of publishing single author collections. But actually, that failed to take account of how much poetry is sold at readings.
Yeah.
One poetry publisher I know, Burning Eye, who published works by performance poets, was telling me that his authors sell hundreds of copies.
Yeah.
Just by going around doing performances. And I've certainly found my poetry outsells my novels, which is extraordinary, and for something that I would never have thought, and you're not told. And it's because people love, if they've heard something they've enjoyed, they want to buy it then and there.
Yeah.
And downloading it or going to the bookshop and buying it just doesn't work. They want the copy then. So yes, get a limited edition short run printed, or get 10 copies at a time from print on demand publishers and take them around with you.
Brilliant. And I would totally agree with you. And you know, I certainly have a number. I saw Ben Okri, you know, Ben Okri, Nigerian poet. I saw him speak in the Millennium, and I've bought, I mean, since then I I buy everything he does, and so much of it has gone out of print as well, which is awful. It's like, you know,
he's a Booker Prize winner.
Yes, he's a Booker Prize winner for fiction, not poetry, yeah. Obviously. And but amazing, you know. And it was when I heard him read his words, I'll never forget his voice, you know, amazing voice. And I think that resonates. So definitely, I think that's a must do for poets listening.
Yes, go out and read. Yeah, even if it is only an open mic, just go and get involved.
Exactly. Right, Dan, that was brilliant. I know we've gone on a bit, sorry about that. But where can people find you and your books online?
They can find everything on my website, which is danholloway.wordpress.com. Or if they Google 79 Rat Press, if they want to look up the other amazing, they're better than my books, so do go there first. 79ratpress.wordpress.com. We have 6 fabulous collections out by new and not so new writers. They're experimental but not difficult. And they're all free to download, as well as being available in limited edition paperback, although 3 of the paperbacks are sold out now.
And if people want to hear you perform, that's all on your website
That's all on my website. Summer is very quiet. I'll be taking my show, The New Libertines, all around the country from the autumn again. We'll be at Stoke Newington, we'll be at Woodstock, we'll be at Cheltenham, we'll be at Chipping Norton, we'll be going to Brighton, London, or Manchester, all sorts of places.
Awesome. No, really exciting. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Dan. That was brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.